Stand up. Stand up for your rights.
Good morning. This is Dave Mazza.
And I'm Joanne Bowman.
And you're listening to Voices from the Edge. And this morning, we're going to kind of keep the conversation going about politics and voting. You know, Amy Goodman was talking a little bit earlier with Greg Palast about stealing votes. Well, we're going to take a different spin on it in the next hour because we're going to look at what it takes to persuade people to vote, how they make those political decisions, whether they do it with their minds or their hearts. And or some other organ of the body, who knows? But we're going to be talking with Drew Weston. He's the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. He's a professor, a clinical psychologist and political strategist, and a professor at Emory University. And he was prompted to write this book to... well, frankly, to kind of lay out a guideline to particularly the Democrats as to how to sort of get back on track in reaching the hearts and minds of voters. And so let's just, Joanne, unless you have any objections, I'm going to just bring Drew on the line.
Please do.
Okay, good morning, Drew.
Good morning.
Well, thank you very much for being with us this morning. And since everybody's talking politics, we had a political debate this week, and, you know, we can't turn on the TV or the radio without hearing about candidates. Let's talk a little bit about your take on how people select candidates. Do people make their decisions with their hearts or their minds?
I think the data are pretty clear that it's mostly with their hearts. I mean, it's not to say that their minds don't enter into it, but most of their judgments are gut-level judgments that summarize everything that they have seen and felt about the candidates, the economy, the war, the current president. That gets kind of summarized in a summary judgment, and that judgment tends to be in the gut.
Well, when I first started reading your book, I saw the words clinical psychologist, and I thought this was going to be a, you know, fairly dry.
Yeah.
Don't dress it up any there, Joanne. Just say what you think. It was quite fascinating, but I was also, I should say for our listeners that it's interesting also because you do discuss sort of the physiology of how this happens, and perhaps you might want to lay out a little bit for our listeners, you know, some of the
findings,
the scientific side of it, if you will.
Oh, sure. Well, I'll just mention a couple that I think are two or three that are most strong. And that one of them is that if you look at the predictors of people's voting behavior over the last 40 years from what are called the National Election Studies, this enormous bank of tens of thousands of interviews with voters for presidential elections, Senate elections, congressional elections, et cetera, what you find is that I'll give the example presidential elections. If you look at what are the best predictors of people's voting behavior, it actually isn't the issues, which has been the standard Democratic approach, which is, you know, let me lay out my 12-point plans on the top 15 issues of the day, and people will look at those plans and compare them to the Republican plans. Yeah. And if you look at it, that hasn't worked out so well for the Democrats in the last 60 years. During that time, since Franklin Roosevelt, they've only managed to elect and reelect one person to the presidency. That was Bill Clinton, mm-hmm. who took a completely different approach. The way people make those judgments is the best predictors from those national election studies, the first and most important, is what do they feel towards the parties and their principles. When you see that D or that R by the person's name, what is it evoke in you, and do you say, I like that, I don't like that? The second best predictor is what do I feel towards this candidate? What gut-level feelings does this person elicit from me? Is it hope? Is it fear? Is it inspiration? And certainly in this election, We're going to come down to some of those emotions now in this next month. Those two factors alone account for virtually all voting behavior. I mean, you know, you get down below that list, you get into people's feelings towards the candidate's personal attributes like leadership and trustworthiness. All the way down the list, you get into specific issues. And then finally, at the bottom of the list is people's knowledge of the facts about the issues. That actually doesn't even enter into the equation in predicting people's voting behavior.
That's a little scary to hear that.
it's a funny thing because in one sense, when I've spoken about this all over the country and And when I'll tell people that you know, reality is that people's gut level feelings towards the candidates and their parties are the first predictor of vote behavior, which accounts for that 80% of votes. And then you get down to their gut level feelings towards the candidates, you know, and people kind of gasp the way I think you just did. Mm-hmm. You know, my first response is that I'm never fond of quoting or paraphrasing Don Rumsfeld, but sometimes you have to work with the brain you have and not the brain you wish you had.
Very good point. So here's the big question for this election season: if people vote based on their gut, how does race play out in this election season?
Well, that's a great question, a million-dollar question. what it's looking right now is that that people are so anxious about paying their mortgage at the end of the month. They are so anxious about the fact that, you know, if you're working class right now and you've considered yourself middle class, you're looking at dropping out of the middle class for the first time in your life. If you're middle class, you're looking at your middle or upper middle class, you're looking at your pension or your 401k, and you're thinking, wait a minute, when did my 401k turn into a 201k? I've got a third of the money I had there last. I mean, I won't even open my you know, I get these things from Fidelity every month telling me about my retirement plan. I'm not even looking at that because I really don't feel like paying for Prozac on top of everything else. So, you know, the issue now is with the economy making everybody so anxious and angry, will that outweigh the latent racial issues that you know, and this gets into a really important question we can get into about, you know, what is the nature of race and racism in America? Is it the old style of, you know, a Jim Crow kind of racism, of overt racism, or is it something that isn't racism in that same sense? It's much more of a it's much more unconscious. It's much more counter to people's conscious values, but it can get activated. And the conservatives have been very, as usual, very impressive at activating it.
Right.
Well, I would just say to our listeners that we're talking this morning with Drew Weston. He's a clinical psychologist and political strategist from Emory University. He's also the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. And so let's go on back to talking with Drew. And again, if you want to join us in this conversation, 503-231-8187. And I'm all out of phone numbers at this point.
But I have a question, Drew. I want to know what happened to the Democratic Party. Why does the Democratic Party need to be fixed? Why does it not have the minds and hearts and souls of the American people?
And it's another great question. This year we're seeing a Democratic Party that seems to be new and revitalized. Part of that is just that, you know, the economy is so bad, our standing in the world is so bad, our destruction of our Constitution is so bad that people have nowhere to turn but left, you know, to slouch towards Massachusetts. So, you know, in some sense, the Democrats have gotten the advantage of the policies of the last several years, mm-hmm. really, you know, coming to fruition, and that fruition not looking too good to the average American. But there is there has been an asymmetry between Democrats and Republicans for the last 40 years, really up until this year, and with the exception of the Clinton years, where Democrats have tried. I mean, I was just listening to what you were saying to your what you're doing in your fundraising drive, and I was thinking, well, you guys are fundraising like Republicans. You're using you've got feeling in your voice. You know, you talk about the importance of keeping our democracy alive and why an independent media is important. You know, that's the kind of stuff that moves people. And this is where Democrats have gone so wrong for so many years, is that there's a particularly among the Democratic consulting class, but it's not just among the consultants. It's among politicians. It's among donors. There is a sense that if you use emotion, somehow that's bad, and that, you know, that we should all be making casting our votes in a rational way, and that any divergence from that is demagoguery, it's propaganda, it's Orwellian. And, you know, the problem with that is that just from an evolutionary standpoint, you know, we all evolved to have emotions for a reason. You know, I don't know about you, but I don't remember Martin Luther King's "I Have a Plan" speech.
That's true.
You know, and if that's the speech he'd given, I don't think we'd remember Martin Luther King. And there's a reason for it. I mean, you know, was he irrational calling people to their better angels by saying, "I have a dream that someday, you know, my children will be judged on the content of their character, not on the color of their skin"? Is that rational? No. I mean, it's not a rational appeal. Is it an ethical and a moral appeal? Absolutely. Is it an emotional appeal? Absolutely. I think the Democrats have gotten confused over the years. Same thing is true with positive and negative campaigning, is that the idea is that if you say anything negative, you shouldn't do that because that's mean or that's irrational or that's playing on people's playing on people's worst nature. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the reality is, if you don't say something bad, for example, when John Kerry didn't say something bad about Abu Ghraib during the entire 2004 election, when it was happening right in the middle of the election, that he was misinforming the hearts and minds of the American public, because they're voting with their gut. And if no one is saying to them, America does not round up innocent people and torture them, if no one says those words in that tone, all they hear is the other side, which is, hey, we have, you know, this is how we had to do things. These are a bunch of dangerous terrorists. If we don't fight them over there, they're going to come over here. If you don't fight fire with fire and those kind of things, people don't get fire in the belly on your side.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, I mean, we're hearing this, you know, through the media filter, is that people don't want to hear that bickering. I mean, bipartisanship is the big, you know, catchphrase this time around. And even the campaigns are obviously zinging in on that. Well, we got to be bipartisan. We shouldn't be doing that. Now, that's obviously not putting any restraints on them in terms of actually engaging in bickering and hitting each other back and forth. But is this just, you know, some campaign blather, or is there room for our people, you know, at some point saying, you know, enough with the emotional, enough with the fighting, we want to actually get down to it? It sounds like you're saying that's not the case.
Well, this is, again, the difference between people's conscious values and their unconscious reactions, mm-hmm. is that consciously no one wants bickering. I mean, everyone says, you know, I don't like negative ads. In fact, some colleagues and I did a study for Anderson Cooper on CNN, where we looked at people's conscious and unconscious reactions to Hillary Clinton's 3 a.m. ad shortly after it had run in Ohio. That was the ad, for people who don't remember it, where it begins, you know, it's 3 a.m. in the morning, and basically is, you know, who do you want to answer that phone? And it was a classic fear-inducing ad that was aimed at saying, you don't want Barack Obama answering that phone because he's untested, he's unknown, he doesn't have the experience, et cetera. And uniformly, people's conscious response to that ad was negative. I mean, they said, I don't like it, it's pandering, it's nasty. And then we measured their unconscious responses in a couple of ways, and one of them was by showing an image of Barack Obama in the middle of a computer screen. We did this on the web. And we asked people, we then show a series of words would come up, and their job was to ignore the word and to click on the words yellow, green, blue, or red, the color that word was written in. So, in other words, here's a series of words coming up, like leadership, terrorist, Muslim, experienced, inexperienced, and their job was to just ignore the word and click on the color that it was printed in. And the reason why that test works, what it does is if something's been activated, in this case by an ad, in your brain, you may not be aware that it's active, but it's at a latent state of activation, or it's been activated. And when you then try to ignore that word, it grabs your attention for about 30, 40 milliseconds. We're talking about thousandths of a second. You can measure this stuff on the web. And so it slows you down in ignoring the word and clicking on the color. So just the long and the short of that is that what that means is that we were able to measure what had been activated unconsciously in people's minds by that ad, by how long did it take them to click that the word was in yellow or was in red. Mm-hmm. And the finding was that even though everyone said, I didn't like the ad, it was pandering, it made me think less of her, here are the four words that jumped out that had been most activated by that ad unconsciously. They were weak, lightweight, Muslim, and terrorist. And the data exactly matched in many ways the exit polls from Ohio where Hillary Clinton ran that ad, and that was that about 60-65% of people said she'd run an unfair campaign against Barack Obama, and those same 60-65% pulled the lever for Hillary Clinton. So the reality is that, you know, people say they don't like attack ads. They say they like bipartisanship. They mean it. They're not lying. That's what their conscious values are. But unconsciously, people are very, very strongly affected by them.
So that raises another question for me, Drew. And this question is, so the Democratic Party bills itself as the Rainbow Coalition. It, you know, it's everybody under the tent. People of color, immigrants, et cetera. That's how they build themselves, but that's not the reality of how the Democratic Party operates, except during election time.
Right.
And so my question is whether or not, how does that play out in your assessment of how the political brain works?
Well, it's complicated because on the one hand, this is again an area where you see that people's conscious beliefs about diversity are often much more positive than their unconscious attitudes. Mm-hmm. And when the average I come from the South, so I live in Georgia, so I know something about Southerners. Mm-hmm. When you've got a southern white rural working class man looking at a candidate for president with a black face, that's going to have an impact. And there's a small percent, and it's even small in the South where 30 years ago you would hear the overt racism, and now you don't hear much of that. You do hear some of it around the water coolers when in South Georgia or in lots of places around the country, but the people who have those conscious racial attitudes aren't voting for Democrats anyway. So, right. This is one of the important lessons for Democrats that they need to know about their big tent, which is that Republicans have no trouble making villains out of liberals. You know, they'll say, you know, they're latte-drinking, sushi-eating, godless atheists. They have no trouble telling a story that's got a villain on the other right. side. Democrats are... I think it was Carvel Mbegala who said that a liberal is someone who worries that someone somewhere will be offended. Well, you know what? You don't worry about offending people who are overt racists any more than you worry about offending people who believe that they have the right to impose their religious views on other people. You don't worry about people who are severely bigoted if you're a Democrat because you're not going to get their votes. You do think about the people who are in the middle and who can be swayed by sentiments and values on the right and on the left. And for those people, the best strategy for dealing with say, having a black candidate for president is to just be open about it. I mean, I would have loved to hear Barack Obama at some point step in front of an audience in rural Georgia and say, "You may have noticed that I'm black." And you know what? You would have seen the tension in everybody's shoulders go down.
Right.
He could easily have gone on to say, you know, I have to tell you, one of the most, there's a story out there that is, you know, this year we hear, you know, negative stories about me. We hear negative stories about John McCain. There's a story going around that's the most offensive, elitist story that I've heard this year, and it's not about me, and it's not about John McCain. It's about you. And that story is that you won't vote for me because I've got a black face.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me tell you something. I haven't seen too many of you stuff your KKK hoods in your pickup trucks on your way over to this rally. That's not what I see. What I see are people who are looking at me and they're asking, does this guy share my values?
Mm-hmm.
Does this guy understand and care about people like me? And you know what? You go into a black neighborhood and a white politician is trolling for votes there.
Right.
I can promise you, black people are asking the exact same question.
Mm-hmm.
So if the question for me is, because I look different, does that raise the bar a little bit for me?
Mm-hmm.
That's not surprising. You want to know, am I enough like you that I can represent you and that I care about people like you? So I want to start by telling you about what I really care about. And I want to start with my children because
Excuse me, Drew.
I feel the same way about you do.
Excuse me, Drew. I want to challenge your question about a white politician in a black church, for example, because have we not been conditioned to believe that a white male is in fact a political candidate? Isn't it much harder for a candidate of color to actually get elected, regardless of who the voters are?
No question it is. I mean, obviously, there's the Bradley effect that someone can be leading in the polls, and then when people get behind the closed doors of the polling booth, it's very different.
Right.
But you know, the gut level the gut level reaction of Democratic consultants on these issues is actually absolutely the opposite of what works and what all the science says, which is what Democrats like to do when they've got a situation like this is to avoid it. I mean,
the classic example
was the Muslim smear on the internet that started a year and a half ago. That is one of those things that, you know, the reaction of the Obama campaign, which has been in so many ways an extraordinary campaign, probably their worst move was their decision to let that Muslim smear campaign fester on the internet for over a year before they said a word about it.
That's
and
right.
They didn't want to say anything because they were afraid by talking about it, it would bring it to people's attention. And you know, it reminds me a lot of in my home field of clinical psychology. There was a debate years ago about, do you ask teenagers who are depressed if they're suicidal? And you know, one side said, well, don't ask them because it might make them think about it. And, you know, I always thought about that from the time I was in training. If that isn't the dumbest thing in the world, if a teenager is really depressed, you're not sticking ideas in their mind by asking them about whether they're suicidal. They've got those ideas. So it's the same thing with the Muslim thing, is when you let something like that fester, then you don't answer it, then first of all, people start thinking it's true because it's unanswered. They think, well, why hasn't anybody answered this? And the second is that even after you convince them consciously that it's not true, now we're down to 10 or 11% of people think that he's a Muslim. And again, those are the same 10, 11% of bigots who are not going to vote Democratic no matter what. But you've got a lot of people who are left with just an uncomfortable feeling that they don't know where it comes from, that came from that Muslim smear sticking in their minds for a long, long time. And you never want to let, it's called, social psychologists call it a sleeper effect. You never want to let negative feelings clank around in there unconsciously for months while you don't detoxify them.
Right.
Well, Drew, one of the things, I mean, we had a presidential debate this week.
Yes.
And people seem to be saying, well, you know, nothing very exciting happened there. But I'd be interested in your take on, from the perspective of your book, how the candidates did.
Oh, yeah. It's so interesting because I have heard a lot of the traditional punditry saying, you know, some people in Politico, I think, said that this was the worst debate ever. I had a very different reaction to it, and that was that I thought this was the first time in a debate that we saw glimmers of the Barack Obama on the stump show up on television in a debate or in an interview format. He has been in one debate after another. He has been controlled. He's been wonkish. He's been refusing to use words that have emotion in them. He's been refusing to say anything that would connect directly with people's guts or their hearts. This time, he came out, and I actually think it's funny. You know, people have talked about how the town hall format was a really good thing for McCain. I think it was great for Barack Obama because he's someone who, when he's in front of people, he connects with them. When he is, you know, just in a room answering questions, he tends to move into the mode of the law professor, and people don't respond to the law professor. So he was, you know, once he started, he got the hang of it. And he started moving towards people and answering their questions and using their first names and, you know, talking about what it's like for them directly. It looked a lot more like Bill Clinton than it looked like the Obama we've seen in every other debate before. So I actually thought this was by far his best performance.
Now, there's some point of diminishing returns in terms of that, you know, sort of turning to the passionate side of things. Because if we look at the vice presidential debates, I mean, that's all Sarah Palin was attempting to do. I mean, there was absolutely no
Substance.
Thank you. When I say the word Sarah Palin, I must admit my brain just sort of locks up. But, you know, I mean, there was a very intentional effort to just hit emotions. And I don't know of anybody who thought it worked well, except maybe the very hardcore Republicans.
Right. And that's an example where she actually did some things that were it reminded me a little bit of a performance that George H.W. Bush had, where he accidentally read an instruction that was given to him that was something like, say with feeling. So he gave some line and then said, say with feeling.
Your name here.
I thought, you know, her saying, well, I'm appealing to Joe Sixpack out there. You know, it reminded me of a little bit of George W. Bush in one of these interviews, one of the few press conferences I think he gave during his entire presidency, when he said, you know, I'm a war president. I'm a war president. It's like he said it over and over and over again. And those were things that should have been in parentheses that think about, you know, you're a war president. That's how you want to convey yourself. But don't come out and say it that way. But I will say on the flip side is that if you're wanting to, I was just, you know, saying a second ago how I thought Barack Obama's performance was much stronger, because what he did was there, he had a combination of the substance, and Joe Biden did exactly the same thing. I thought Biden did a super job, where he had a combination of the substance that you heard, but he never launched in, there are a couple times when he launched into Senate speak, but most of the time, when he'd launch into an answer, he'd start it with something that grabbed you emotionally so that you'd know where his heart was, mm-hmm. and then he told you where his head was. Mm-hmm. And just election after election, so there's so much data showing that if you essentially create an emotional argument which begins with something that grabs people and that makes them know where you're coming from, you then put the meat in the center. And then you end with something that grabs them again, you're going to do much better off at persuading people than if you just give the meat in the center and you don't let them know where your values are. I mean, this is one of the things that Republicans have done right for many years.
And Drew, actually, your last conversation about the vice presidential debate raised a question for me. How is gender playing out in this presidential election?
Well, the irony is, I think, in many ways, that Sarah Palin was put on the ticket because the idea was to appeal to women and to grab some of those Hillary voters. If you watch the dial tests as she was speaking in that, they had them on one of the cable stations. She was appealing to men with that Joe Sixpack stuff, and with the, you know, you could picture her playing pool with you in a bar, and she'd be one of those women who'd. She'd touch your arm a lot. She'd make you feel good, right. And you'd feel, oh, she'd
be a little giggly.
Oh yeah, and you know, you'd feel attractive, even though she was thinking, "Boy, this is one ugly sucker." but so the men were the independent men were responding well to her. The women were not buying it. They did not like the winks. They did not like, you know, calling out at you there to you third graders at wherever the third graders
right,
were.
Right.
That stuff did not play well with women, and I think there was a mistake that that both sides actually made on this one, which was to think that women vote with their internal plumbing as opposed with their brains and their hearts, and that, you know, that they were going to all look at this woman and say, oh, it's a woman, I must vote for her. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw the hilarious piece that Samantha Bee did on the Daily Show on that, but Jon Stewart kept asking her questions right after the choice of Sarah Palin and say, well, you know, what about her position on abortion? You know, she doesn't even believe that incest victims should be able to have an abortion. And Samantha Bee comes back and says, well, you know, John, as a vagina American, I just have he'd come back with one after another of these kind of rational things. But, yeah, but she's against equal pay for equal work. And she'd say, John, boobies. there was a way that both parties were thinking really both campaigns were thinking really stereotypically about this. Obviously it matters. Gender
identity matters. Drew, so what I've noticed in the debates, is that the men will not take her on, right? I noticed how Biden was very careful, right, to not be very aggressive in his response, he showed a lot of control and just not just saying, oh, please, woman, you just have no clue, right? There were many times that he had an opportunity, I think, to be really, really aggressive and just show how ignorant she really is for the post that she's running for.
Right.
And he didn't do it. And is it because there are different expectations if you're debating a female versus debating a male candidate?
This is, again, where I have to say I part company with the Obama campaign. I think in strategy, I think they were very smart to not go after her. I mean, what you don't want to say to someone of somewhat modest intellectual means who's running for vice president, you have modest intellectual means. Because you know, the reality is that the average American has average intellect. So, you know, when you attack someone like her and you say, well, you're kind of a moron, aren't you? that's not a very useful way to go. And you know, we've seen that, you know, someone who is a moron has gotten elected twice. And, you know, when I went through that list of predictors of voting behavior, competence and intelligence are actually not high on the list. Mm-hmm. Americans seem to be happier to have a guy who got into the Air Force Academy but because his father and grandfather were admirals and who ended up fifth from the bottom of his class of almost 900. They like that better than the guy who went to Harvard Law School. And mm-hmm. that part's a shame, you know. But there are ways to talk about those kind of things that are much more effective. I mean, for example, when Sarah Palin was picked as the vice presidential nominee, it would have been really easy for the Obama campaign to prevent the bounce that she got in the polls. That frankly, they were lucky that her luster wore off, because mm-hmm. she can be quite talented as a speaker, mm-hmm. And she could have drawn some people in. But they were fortunate about how it played out. Mm-hmm. But if they had simply begun by saying two things, one of them was that was before the opening gavel ever opened at the Republican convention. One of them was that was one of the most reckless choices made by a presidential candidate, particularly a 72-year-old man who's had a 4-time recurrent melanoma, to pick someone who's wouldn't be on anybody's short list of 1,000 to be the potential leader of the free world, let alone, you know, one heartbeat away. That's the kind of thing that could easily have been said and would have reshaped the discussion from before she opened her mouth. About it would have changed the expectations. It wouldn't have been, can you read your lines well? It would have been, well, wait a minute, should this person be a heartbeat away from a guy who the actuarial tables will tell you in the next 3 years is not likely to make it?
That's right.
Well, on that somber note, well, Drew, I wish we had another hour to talk about. There's a lot of other questions we'd love to ask. Unfortunately, time has flown by. I want to thank you for sharing your insights on our current presidential debate, as well as how we do politics and how we should do it successfully. And again, we've been talking with Drew Weston, the author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. He's a clinical psychologist and political strategist, and he's written a book that is by no means dry and academic. It's quite fascinating, and highly recommend you pick it up to get a good take on not this only this current campaign, but all the past ones and the ones coming up.
So, and how do we build for the future? Yes.
So thank you, Drew.